Time to get started. You guys enjoying Dev Day so far? Good. Okay, my name is Aaron Sconard. I'm with Pluralsight. Pluralsight is a .NET developer training company. We focus on Microsoft technologies. We got a lot of guys here at the show speaking this week, so stop by our booth and check out what we're doing. This talk is one of my favorite talks that I get to do at the show because we get a chance to kind of take a few steps back and think about rest and why we all need some. And in context with SOAP specifically, you know, with web services over the years, we've done a lot of thinking about how to make things easier, how to make things interoperable, how to make the world a better place by increasing the standards that we work with and trying to reduce platform dependencies. And we've kind of lost touch a little bit with why we went down that path with SOAP. And so during this session, we're going to kind of focus on a few fundamental reasons why you might want to consider using REST instead of SOAP for your architectural style for services moving forward. And one of the reasons why this is such an important discussion to have right now is because with this new evolution of cloud computing, REST is really becoming the dominant model for interacting with cloud platforms. If you're going to be building solutions on the cloud, whether it be Microsoft, Amazon, Google, whichever cloud platform you might choose, it's very likely that REST is going to be the programming model that you're either forced to use or that you'll most likely choose to use. And so it's important to kind of get your head around, you know, why REST is important these days, what it means, how it's different than SOAP, and to kind of look at how you'll start writing the code. What does the code look like? How's the code different than what you might write with SOAP? And so that's my goal in this presentation, to walk you through that progression. There won't be a ton of code in this session because this is more about the concepts, but at the end I want to make sure we have some time to at least sit down and see what it's like to build a client application that talks to a RESTful service on the web today. We'll actually go up and talk to twitter.com and just see what it's like to consume that using some of the new APIs that are available in .NET. And then we'll also see what it's like to implement a simple RESTful service with WCF 4.0. And you can do this in a lot of different ways, so I'm just going to choose a couple of my favorite techniques and show you those here in this session. Okay, so let's dive in. The first thing we want to talk about is what REST is, fundamentally. This is something that some of you may be familiar with, some of you may not be. REST is an acronym. It stands for Representational State Transfer. And it was the title of a chapter in a doctoral thesis written by a man named Roy Fielding. And this was written quite a while ago, back in the year 2000. And when he was doing his PhD in California, Roy Fielding, if you don't know, is one of the principal authors of many of the specs that define how the web works today. So he was one of the authors of HTTP, the specification. He was one of the authors of the URI specification, and many others. And so in a lot of ways, he's considered one of the fathers of the web, right alongside Tim Berners-Lee and some of their cohorts. So he's been a very principal player in this whole thing of how the web was designed and how it grew to be what it is today. So when he sat down to do his doctoral thesis, he wanted to codify for everybody what the principles were in the network architecture that allowed the web to scale the way it did. And that chapter 5 in his doctoral thesis, was titled Representational State Transfer. And it kind of outlined all those design principles, all those design constraints that you would have to follow when building any kind of network architecture that wants to scale, that needs to scale over time and grow, which is what the web has done for us, as we've seen. So that's what REST, that's where the word REST came from. The reason REST started to be touted and thrown around in the industry as a way to describe services was because of soap. Soap came out in the late 90s, you know, right around the time that he wrote this chapter in his thesis. And people started looking at soap from the perspective of how is soap going to scale, right? Does soap embody the principles that you need to have for this architecture to really scale over time in a natural way? And there was a lot of disagreement about whether or not it could. You know, the people who designed soap didn't really design it with that in mind. They designed soap to be basically a remote object access protocol, right? That's what the O stood for, right? It was about objects and accessing those objects across the wire. So it was inherently RPC-based. And so when the folks that were involved with the web started looking at soap with a critical eye, they started realizing that it kind of violated some of those core tenets that were inherent in the web and that you kind of need to have in a highly scalable network architecture. And so they started, the debate began at that point. And there were soap proponents and there were REST proponents. The guys on the website started saying, look, go read chapter 5 in Roy's thesis. It's called REST. And that's when the whole REST started being thrown around as a common term. So we kind of talk about REST services or RESTful services. Those are some terms that are used a lot. And we talk about SOAP services. And they're two very different ways of thinking about building things. SOAP is very RPC-based and kind of object-oriented, typically. Doesn't have to be, but that's the way it typically turns out. And REST is much more like how the web works, HTTP. So why did we do this? Why did we go down the path of building SOAP? Well, there were a few fundamental things that the SOAP fans wanted to have. They wanted to have this notion of transport neutrality, right? Where I could have, you know, a service architecture that I could potentially use over a lot of different transports, not just the web transport, not just HTTP. I might want to invoke services over TCP, over MSMQ, over SMTP, etc. And so the SOAP guys really wanted to make that possible. They also wanted to make it possible to do things like security, RM, and transactions, things that we were used to having in COM and CORBA. They wanted to make that possible over web services. And so they didn't really feel like that would be possible just using some of the techniques that are inherent in the web. And so the SOAP guys were kind of going in this direction, and the REST guys were saying, look, we think it should be like this. It should be more like the web. And there kind of began this great divide in the industry around, you know, SOAP versus REST. And over the first 5 years of SOAP's existence, that debate was very, very strong and heavy. And you either did one or the other. You typically didn't see things in kind of a more reasonable way where you might choose to use both at the same time. But today, it has changed dramatically. I mean, people have really come around to realizing through their own experience, through their own hard knocks, you know, of kind of working with SOAP and scaling SOAP and dealing with SOAP in some of these complicated scenarios. And they've realized on their own that it's not really the perfect solution for everything. And that in a lot of situations, REST is indeed actually a much better choice. Whoa. Don't want that to happen. Let's jump back here and make sure I get plugged in. I thought this thing was working. Apparently this power source. If I could get some assistance with that power source for some reason. Oh, it was an update message. I'm sorry. Oh, thank you. Okay, we don't want to do that then. See if that pops up one more time. I'll kill it. Good thing we have these screens right here. I wouldn't have noticed that. So anyway, this is something that's been going for a long time. But now we're in a place where everybody, including Microsoft was one of the big proponents of SOAP. And so for a very long time, they did not want to encourage rest. You know, the key players, the key architects, some of the people within Microsoft, you know, this debate happened internally as well within the company, and no one really wanted to come out and say, yeah, rest is good for these things and soap is good for these things. For the longest time, everyone was saying, look, you want to do soap. And it was because, you know, all these vendors, and it wasn't just Microsoft, there were other vendors too doing the exact same thing, but it took Microsoft a while until .NET 3.5 to come around and say, look, we've got to provide a first-class experience for rest as well. Before that, there really wasn't a good model in WCF, at least, for doing REST. And so you had to fall back to some of the just the kind of the lower-level HTTP APIs to do it. You know, whereas on some of the other platforms, we had things like Ruby on Rails coming out and just really natural programming models for building RESTful applications. So I'm kind of describing this to explain how Microsoft has gone through this evolution. So has the industry. And now as cloud computing is taking form, I think it's pretty obvious to most people that REST is one of the dominant models for building web services today and in the future. It's going to be very, very prevalent, probably more prevalent than SOAP, I would say, from this point forward. SOAP will still be used in a lot of enterprise scenarios, you know, in the typical scenarios where you may have used COM+ or a CORBA in the past. But if you're building services that need to be deployed on the web, that need to scale, that need to have broad interoperability and reach, then it's very likely that REST might be a better choice. Okay, anybody who tells you that one is always better than the other is probably trying to sell you something, just like the vendors, you know, did in the past. So, you know, we're going to talk through this as we go through this, and we'll see what the good things are about REST, what some of the bad things are. And I'll talk about SOAP at the end, too, and we'll really try to clarify what I'm seeing in the industry today and what most people tend to use as their decision-making points about when to use one versus the other. But it's definitely important to start thinking about REST. And you know, especially if you're going to be moving towards the cloud, what does this mean to you? How do I get prepared to build things this way? What's the right framework that I should be using? And how do I incorporate these things into the solutions that we have? Okay, so that's what REST is. SOAP, again, is a transport-neutral model, whereas REST is a transport-specific model. When you do REST, you're typically always going to be using HTTP. REST itself doesn't say you have to use a specific transport. It's more about the architecture, more about the design constraints. But in practice, if you're doing REST, you're doing HTTP. That's it. That's your transport. There's one interface, and it's very, very simple. Okay? It builds on the HTTP methods, get, post, put, and delete. That's your interface. But you can use any data format that you want in conjunction with that interface. Most people use XML or JSON, but you can use, you know, specific XML dialects like Atom or RSS. You can use your own custom formats if you want. You could even do binary if you wanted. But obviously, the more open the data format, the broader the reach that you're going to enjoy with your solution. Okay, so let's dive in and talk about one of the key differences here. So REST, like I said, is not RPC. Okay, we know that SOAP, when you sit down to build a SOAP-based service, you're typically building a service that has a bunch of RPC methods in it. You have a get user, an add user, a remove user. You might have another set of operations for your locations in the system, for your bookmarks, whatever the data model might be. But it's typically, in a lot of applications, most of the operations are CRUD operations. Create, retrieve, update, delete. It's the same four things for all of our different entities. And we end up defining all of these different operations for dealing with these things. When we could really just have one standard uniform contract that kind of gives us that CRUD ability over any kind of data. And that's really what REST does. REST gives you a single interface, and it causes you to focus on the resources, the nouns, and not the verbs. So whereas with SOAP we define verbs, with REST we actually focus on the resources, and we already know what the verbs are. There's one set of verbs. It's a standard uniform interface defined by the HTTP spec. It's get, post, put, and delete. And that gives you CRUD. Okay? With we can create things with post and put. We can update things with post and put. We can get things to retrieve, and we can delete things to delete. So we can do the whole spectrum of CRUD operations very naturally with the simple HTTP interface. And the beauty behind that is that once you understand that interface, you understand how to work with any RESTful resource. Okay, it's the same interface. The semantics are the same for the operations, no matter which resource we're talking to. We know exactly what Git does. We know what the guarantees are. We know it's idempotent. We know it's safe. We know what put is and what that means. Right, and those semantics are really important when you figure out how to build all the infrastructure and all the applications and routers that might exist in the world, right? That our messages will be traveling through. So, the idea that we've got a simple interface that everybody understands is key. That's one of the key things about REST that's different than SOAP. Once you spend, an hour learning how REST works and what the semantics of the interface are, that will then take you forward for years and years and years and allow you to work with any RESTful service you come in contact with. Okay? Whereas with SOAP, every time you sit down to integrate with a new SOAP service, you've got to learn everything about that service from scratch, by getting a piece of documentation that describes the semantics of all the APIs. You've then got to go get a WSDL definition and try to generate code for your framework. And you're starting over every time. Every time it's like, okay, here we go again. Right? And there's a lot of overhead in that. Makes it a lot more difficult to figure things out. And when you think about building a large-scale, complex distributed system that might consist of thousands of services, think about the complexity and how much it kind of exponentially grows as those services, keep adding more and more operations. Then think how hard it gets when we start to version things and we start to version operations in those thousands of services that exist. And a lot of that complexity comes from the sheer fact that we have new operations that we have to understand, that we have to code understanding, about into our logic. And that's what makes SOAP so fundamentally more difficult. The other thing that's different is with SOAP, we have kind of a standard message format. We have the SOAP protocol. We know what that format looks like. We have a header section. We have a SOAP envelope with headers. And then we have a body. Whereas with REST, we're just going to be transferring XML messages, typically, or JSON messages. There typically aren't any headers in the XML unless we design, those into our message itself. And we rely on the transport, HTTP, to carry headers and things like that we need. And we're going to rely on the transport as much as possible, to give us the features we need for things like security, right? Whereas with SOAP, we try to kind of ignore the transport, and we would say, we're going to try to put all that stuff into the message and have a standard message-based way of doing it. With REST, we're not doing that. Okay, we're really going to embrace the transport and try to, get the most out of it because, look, we've got the web, right? The web is there. We've got all this security infrastructure that's been built. We've got, years and years of testing and hacking and all these things that have been going on, and we've got good solutions to a lot of these problems already that you're using. You're using them in your applications today, your web apps. And why would your web services need to be any different? So that's one of the fundamental arguments that's often used when talking about these things. So to summarize some of this intro stuff that we've been talking about, just what is REST and what REST isn't, I wanted to kind of codify REST into four fundamental tenets. Whenever you think about a RESTful service, your service should probably embody all four of these tenets to really be considered a RESTful service, at least according to Roy, the author of this word. So the first principle is that the web is really a graph of linked resources. That's one of the principles of REST, is that everything is linked together. Okay, and you figure out how to consume an application by navigating around the relationships through the links. Okay, so when you sit down to design a service, a restful service would be one that is also a web of linked resources. Your service is a web of things. And those things contain data, right? And potentially do things. And, you know, for someone that's going to use your service, they'll walk up to the root of your service, and then they'll navigate around and figure out how to get to everything that's in it. They don't have to know the exact location of everything up front, because that could change over time. One of the key benefits of the web and this principle in general is that versioning, we've always got kind of a plan B when it comes to versioning. If URLs break, which they do on us all the time, you might have a bookmark to something on Amazon, and then Amazon changes their URL scheme, and that bookmark doesn't work anymore. Does that mean you're out of luck? Not usually. You can usually go back to the root of Amazon.com, go to search, find the thing again, get back to a new link, because it's a web of linked resources. So we can always get back. And that's kind of, you know, one of the principles that you should be thinking about when you're building your services now in a restful way. A restful service is not a set of operations. It's not a set of actions. It's a web of interconnected resources that we navigate. And we can benefit from that just like we do on the web today. All of those resources that we use are now identified by URIs. So every single thing that makes up that web of resources has a unique identifier. It has a GUID, and that GUID is a URL. And that's the URL that we use to identify it, and we can always go back and get to it, and we can retrieve it, we can update it, we can delete it using that unique URI that always exists. Okay? So we know that URLs are very important in this context. We also know that these resources will all support a uniform interface. And that interface, again, is HTTP, so get, post, put, and delete. Every resource may not support the full interface. We might have some resources that you can only get you might only get them. You might have others that you can get and update. You might have other resources where you can create things. So you kind of have to know, you know, you have to have some documentation in place that explains for each resource what are we allowed to do, which of these operations applies. But it's the same set of operations. And once I know that I can do a get on this, I know what that means. I know what get means implicitly. I don't have to go read something to tell me that. And then finally, the way we achieve late binding is through following links. This is probably the thing that people have the hardest time with, because when you build a RESTful service like this and you really use links to find your way around, it feels kind of weird. It feels kind of wrong when you're writing the code, because, you know, it feels like it should just be easier than that sometimes. And you know, I'm not saying this is the perfect way to do it all the time, but if you're definitely trying to create a system that is easier to version and evolve over time, this gives you a lot of advantages. I wrote an article in MSDN Magazine about a year ago now, maybe less, titled Building RESTful Services with XHTML. And so the article walks through how to build a RESTful service using MVC as the platform, as the framework. And the service itself is really a navigatable web. And the resources you get back are actually XHTML-based, which we can program against on the client. And it's very different. It's a very different way of thinking about building a service than what you're used to with something like Windows Communication Foundation, where you just have these strongly typed classes that you're serializing back and forth. In that application, we didn't have classes like that we were serializing back and forth. But it was still a web service that we could program just like a WCF service. I mean, we still got the same net benefit. That's a good example of this tenet, because in that particular application, I show you how you can walk up to the root of the service, you can get the list of bookmarks back, you can navigate around this bookmark service and retrieve things, update things, delete things, and you do that all via code. So ultimately, when you think about building a service this way, what we're really talking about is just replacing the human being in the equation with code. right? Your RESTful service is just like a web app. It has the same principles. These are the same principles that would describe any web app that you've ever built. That's what REST is. It describes the web. Okay? So what we're saying is if we build services like this, then it's possible to take the human out of the equation, the guy sitting in front of the web browser, and we can put another piece of code in there. And the code can do that same job. And he'll do it very much the same way that a human does. Okay? So that, in a nutshell, is what REST is. Now let's take a few minutes to talk about why. Why you would want to do REST. I've got four reasons for you. The first reason, and we're seeing this more and more today as SOAP continues to mature, is that most people just don't need SOAP. They don't need a lot of the features that SOAP comes with. I mentioned a couple of them already. Transport neutrality, the ability to do SOAP over MSMQ or TCP, etc. How many of you are using services today over something other than HTTP? Raise your hands. Okay, there are some. It looks like there's probably maybe about 15 in the room here out of everybody. How many of you are using HTTP for services today? That's pretty much everybody in the room. So that illustrates the point. SOAP still has a place. If you're doing those other things, that makes sense to use SOAP. But if you're only doing HTTP and you only intend to do HTTP, then you don't need one of the major features that SOAP was intended to provide. The other reason, the other thing that most folks don't need are a lot of those WS star specifications that SOAP was meant to provide. That was the other kind of big thing that came with SOAP. Things like WS security and WS secure conversation and trust. Things like WS reliable messaging and WS atomic transactions. Things like that. In practice, I don't really see hardly anybody using the WS reliable messaging and transaction specs. People do use security. That's the one thing that does kind of push people towards SOAP. There is a lot of goodness in the security architecture that they built into WS Star. So that's the one thing that people use. But if you realize that in your particular architecture, that the web security techniques that you typically use, like SSL and some of the authentication patterns and authorization techniques you use in your web apps, if those are good enough for what the kinds of services you're trying to build, then you don't need that whole other aspect of SOAP. You don't need a SOAP envelope. You don't need XML-based headers. You don't need all that stuff. We can just do it, you know, with the web. We can just do it with HTTP. Okay, so if you find yourself just doing basic SOAP services, you know, if you're using ASMX services, ASP.NET Web Services today, and you're not using any of that advanced stuff, then you're a really good candidate for just doing REST, because REST will be simpler, it'll be easier in a lot of ways for other people to consume, and it will be a lot more scalable over time. Okay? So that's reason number one. Reason number two is that REST is actually much simpler than SOAP once you get into it from an architectural perspective. It's uniform and it's highly composable. Those are three characteristics that are really important about this. Now, when you say it's simpler, it's kind of a matter of perspective. Everything's perception, right? People often think that REST is harder than SOAP because when you sit down to write the code on the client side, you don't typically get to do an add web reference or an add service reference, and you don't get a proxy class with method calls. Because remember what we said? It's not RPC. REST is not RPC. So if you design an architecture that's not RPC, you really don't want that to begin with. But that's kind of the knee-jerk reaction that people have when they sit down and they see, you know, what it's like to build your first REST client, which I'm going to show you how to do here in a second. It's kind of like, wow, I'm dealing with HTTP directly. It feels like I shouldn't be doing that. They've told me all these years that we should hide that stuff, that I shouldn't touch it. And now I'm doing it, so it must be wrong. Right? And that's kind of the natural reaction that people have. But if your operations are get, post, put, and delete, and you have a class you can use that has a get, post, put, and delete method on it, and you're just sending entities across the wire, which are your resources, how's that any harder? I don't understand that. Right, I'm going to show you a class that they've actually shipped in the WCF REST Starter Kit, which is up on CodePlex. It's a kind of a researchy thing right now. It's not going to be in .NET 4.0, but it will probably be in the next version of .NET after that. But you can grab it today. It's just a little client class that makes doing REST on the client side really, really easy. And it's just HTTP. But they give you a lot of different ways to move back and forth between your message types and the classes that you're using within your code. And it's just get, post, put, and delete. So I would argue that when you're doing REST and you've got that one class that you can learn to love and understand intimately, and you can just use that thing for the rest of your life, that's easier than having to generate a new class every single time with an add service reference and then figure out all the nuances and all the problems of actually using it. Right? I just want the same thing, right? Because all my services are REST-based. They all do the same contract. So I want one class that I can trust, that I know how it works, and it's just get, post, put, and delete. And then it's just the problem is just about the messages, right? It's just about how do I consume the data. And if you think about that idea, how simple that is, that actually describes what Microsoft has recently done with what used to be called ADO.NET Data Services, which is now Windows Communication Foundation Data Services. That is just a standard model on top of WCF and REST. And so you can walk up to a database and say, make this a REST service, and it will just do it. You do it right on top of an EF data model or on top of an iQueryable object model, and you just get it for free because they know how it's supposed to work. And so they can just make it really, really simple, right? So don't be, just don't have that reaction. When you sit down and look at it and you find yourself doing HTTP code when you're doing REST, that doesn't equate, that doesn't mean that it's harder. It just means that it's different, right, than what we were doing before. But the contract is still the same. We just have one of them. And there's just four operations. So it's not RPC like SOAP. It's all about the messages. And the interface, because it's uniform, it's highly composable. Think about the web today and everything that we have out there. I mean, you're building new web apps all the time that you just plug in to this huge distributed system, and they become part of everything. Within a few days, Google and Windows Live, and everybody's indexing your sites. People can search and find them. Your content's being cached everywhere. All this stuff just happens automatically when you plug your app into this thing, right? And that's because there's a uniform interface that everyone has built around. And there's huge power in that, right? Because now your stuff just works with everything else that's out there. It's just like Legos. I use Legos to describe this Lego. I always get, especially over in Europe, I get slapped on the wrist when I say Legos. Lego is a great analogy because think about the interface with Legos. Sorry, Lego. Think about the interface. There's just a couple of different ways to plug Lego components together, right? My good friend Tim Ewald would say there's actually four. He knows of the four ways. You know, the skinny pieces you can lay between the pegs, and obviously you can go top down. And there's a couple of others that I have no idea what they are, but it's simple, right? There's only a few ways to plug these components together. And they're building new Lego components all the time, robotics things, all these fancy components, but they all adhere to the same simple uniform interface, right? And there's power in that because that means whenever someone gets a new Lego component, that will work with everything else. Oh! Oh my gosh. That's like classic sin for presenting. I mean, I should have known better than that. Oh my word. Okay. Well, we'll wait for that to come back up. But I have a story to tell you. So we know that there's power in Lego, right? And you know, my kids, they can sit down and in minutes, You know, if I dump a box of Lego components in front of them, they know how to do it, right? It's just kind of like, it's so simple that they can just sit down and intrinsically know, you know, that these things kind of go together, and they can explore it and figure out how to build things, and they start playing, and before you know it, they're building a little car, and then pretty soon they're building a big tower, and then they might build a hotel building that's this big, right? And there's power in that because, you know, once you understand that interface, you can really start composing and building complex things. You start with small things, and you grow, and you build from there. And I remember, you know, a lot of people, when they think about REST services, they think, you know, how can you do anything serious with that, right? You just got four operations, get, post, put, and delete. How could you build, like, a highly transactional banking application with that? Is that possible? And indeed it is. It's definitely just as possible to build something highly complex like a transactional banking system using REST. It's just as possible as it is with SOAP. There's really not a big difference. It's just different, right? It's a different model for how you do that kind of stuff. It's nice of it. It's going to try to take me right back to where I was. Okay, so here we are. I apologize about that. So I remember the first time that I went to Legoland. Anybody here been there? Legoland? Great place to go. It's really fun, especially if you're a Lego fan. You know, they have just some amazing things built. And the first time I went there, I saw the Volvo XC90 off in the distance. It was right around the time this new car had come out. And I thought, oh, cool, they've got the new car up there. I'm going to go check it out. I'd heard about it. And from a distance, it looked like the real thing. That blue one is made out of Lego. Okay, the one behind it is the real car. And it just kind of illustrates that this concept, right? That even though the interface is so simple, you can still build highly complex things like a transactional banking application using Lego, right? Using REST. You can do it. It may not be the most natural thing sometimes, but you can do it. You know, it's possible. It's highly composable. And when you think about the scope of the web today and how big the web is and how interconnected everything is and how, you know, we can just pick up new Lego pieces, new web apps, and plug them in to everything else that we've been doing, highly powerful, you know, in terms of that concept. So that's one of the reasons, fundamental reasons why you should be thinking about REST seriously. The apps you build when you use REST just automatically plug in to the web and everything else, and it's very natural for people to use it because they already know how to use Lego. They already know how to do REST. They do it every day. It's no different. REST also provides higher interoperability and broader reach. Okay, all you need to use it is a simple XML and HTTP library, typically, which you'll find on any platform. You know, any programming language known to mankind, you can find one. It's more interoperable than SOAP in that regard. Okay, SOAP is not more interoperable than REST. It's the other way around. You'll get broader reach with REST because there's fewer layers in between. When you look at the actual code that's firing, that's executing, there's not as much going on with REST. In SOAP, you have all this translation stuff going on, all that serialization. With REST, you don't necessarily have to have that. Typically, you don't. Okay, and that's, again, one of the main reasons why it's becoming the canonical way of doing things on the cloud today. Okay? So now that we've talked about those four reasons of why REST is... Well, there's one other reason, actually. In fact, it's this one right here. Sorry, I went forward and skipped this slide. The other main reason, reason number four, is that REST is just how the web works. When you build a RESTful service, you get all the features of the web with it. You get bookmarking, for example. People can bookmark your service. You get caching. You just implicitly get the benefits of HTTP caching in your service, which is huge. That's one of the main reasons why people want to do this, right? I remember when some of our friends that were building MSDN, they were building the back-end system for MSDN up in Redmond, they were helping architect the system and thinking about the right way to do it. They wanted it to be all service-based so that we could plug it into Visual Studio and, you know, lots of different consumers can just plug into MSDN. And when they sat down to think about what it would take to build that thing with SOAP, they realized that one of the fundamental issues was going to be caching, and that they were going to have to build this whole caching infrastructure on top of their SOAP services to make this stuff work at the scale of MSDN. Whereas if they would just use a RESTful architecture, they would get all those same benefits for free through HTTP. It's just the web, right? I mean, we already have that. They already have that at Microsoft for their web apps. So you get all that stuff just kind of built in out of the box. Now, now that we've talked about the goodness of REST, let's talk about why you might want to use SOAP. SOAP is definitely a more natural model given what most Microsoft developers are probably used to doing over the past couple of decades. If you've been building COM-based applications, you know, DCOM, COM+, if you've kind of gone through that whole evolution of the Microsoft stack and you've been doing this stuff for a while, SOAP is just going to feel like the next thing. And I often talk about SOAP today as really just kind of the next DCOM. It's basically the next version of COM. It's the new version of COM Plus that works in a highly interoperable way. But it gives you all of those same capabilities, right? You get the same kind of security capabilities, the same kind of reliable messaging, the same kind of, you know, distributed transaction functionality that you would want. It does it over XML, so it is more interoperable. But you're still only going to probably be able to interoperate with three or four big vendors and their technology, the ones that can afford to build this stuff, because it's really hard to do. It's really hard to build it, right? So you've got Microsoft, IBM, Oracle, Sun, you know, those guys. And, you know, you can probably count them on one or two hands. But if you're doing that kind of stuff and you're working in an enterprise environment and you've got training issues where you don't want to have to teach all your developers how to do this new REST thing, then SOAP can be better just from that perspective, from a productivity angle. Right, REST can be a better choice. And the other big thing is security. When people are looking for a message-based security architecture, and this is often very important to banks, for example, you know, where they want to be able to sign and encrypt pieces of a message, and they want to make sure that, you know, the signatures travel with them and no one can tamper with those things. We can prove who it came from and all those kinds of things. That's really hard to do without SOAP. I mean, you can do it. There are specs there that, you know, you could build into a RESTful application, but that's just kind of built into SOAP. That's what SOAP was meant to do. Okay, so if you're dealing with those kinds of security scenarios, SOAP is probably a better choice. Okay? When you break it down at a kind of a broad scale, what I usually tell people is if you're building web-facing services that need to scale, that the public and business partners are going to consume, REST is a pretty good default first choice. When you're building things within a Microsoft enterprise environment, then SOAP might be a better default choice. Okay, because it's going to be a little more natural. You're probably going to want some of those COM Plus features. And it's more like building, you know, middleware than building web-facing services. Does that make sense? And that's kind of the way I see it happening, too. When I go into different environments, that's what I see. When people are building things that they need to expose to business partners, they typically just put up an XML endpoint somewhere, which is essentially REST. Right? They might use SOAP, but they're not really benefiting all that much from it. So sometimes they'll do SOAP for a while and then kind of switch back. In fact, that's what Google did in the very beginning. When Google put up their very first web service API for search, it was SOAP-based. And they had that up there for a couple of years. Then they realized, man, we're not really using anything with SOAP here. The only reason why they did it was because they wanted their clients to get a method called do Google search. That was the only reason they used SOAP. And then after they kind of, you know, understood this and really saw that there's really no reason to keep using SOAP for this web service, they got rid of it. And they deprecated the SOAP API. Now it's just all REST-based and AJAX-based. And a much better fit for a company like Google in that particular scenario. So, you know, there's not a single rule of thumb that you can always use to say, okay, in this case, do this, in that case, do that. But if it's web-facing, definitely think about REST, because you're probably going to benefit from just doing things like the web, the way the web works. If it's local to your enterprise and more of kind of middleware type stuff, then using more of a SOAP-based infrastructure can give you kind of a nice hybrid model, still highly interoperable, and with the possibility of exposing those pieces to business partners, but it's not going to give you all those same benefits as REST. Okay? So now that we've kind of gone through all that, let's break away from the discussion, the high-level concepts, and actually look at some code. See what this looks like and see, you know, how easy it is or how hard it is based on where you're at today to do some of this stuff. So the first thing I want to do is open up a browser. And I'm just going to search for the Twitter. Let me just search for the Twitter REST API. Hopefully I've got some internet here. I tested it just before I got up here. Well, it looks like it's trying. Does anybody else have internet in here? Let me try that, re-plugging it in here one more time. Okay, this is not going to work very well if we don't have internet. Yeah, let me try that. Ah, much better. Thank you, Keith. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to search for the Twitter REST API. This is, you know, Twitter is a pretty common application. A lot of you here this week are using it. If you just browse out to the Twitter website, you can kind of get to this page here that describes what their REST API is. And notice there's just a bunch of resources that you can go access. And some of these things you can actually just go browse to. You know, you can say, okay, well, here's the URL to go get the public Twitter timeline. And this is a GET request. Notice that if I want these different formats back, I can type in any of those things as my extension. So if I, let's bring up a different browser window. Let me do this in IE so I get the nice XML support too. If I just say publictimeline.xml, I can go get it. This right here is one of the key features of REST, is that I can just start browsing the service. I can start testing the service without writing any code. And I can see what the data looks like that I'm getting back. I can start maneuvering around the data, working with the data. You can't do this with SOAP, right? With SOAP, you've got to start making method calls and use some kind of client tester. If I want JSON, let's actually do Atom. Let's get Atom back. Here's some Atom, and that'll get formatted as an Atom feed. And if there's links in here, I can actually navigate those links and move around, right? So, you know, cool stuff. I can also get JSON back. And this will download JSON for me. That's the JSON file I'm getting back. Right? So straight away, we can just go to this thing and start figuring out kind of what it looks like to start browsing this this RESTful service. And then it shows me, you know, down here, here's what the data is going to look like. Here's some client-side help if you want to use these different tools to work with it, et cetera. Now, some of these APIs will give you schemas as well. They'll give you XML schema definitions that you can then use to go generate client-side classes if you do want to use serialization. But if I want to start consuming this thing, I can just start writing XML code, and away I go. Right? I've got XML coming back, JSON, or Atom, and I just choose my client-side API for working with that stuff. Let me show you a couple of examples of doing this. In fact, in order to save time and be able to show you a few more things that I want to show you, I'm going to bring up a couple that I've already got prepared here. Here's a simple solution that was built using that one class I was telling you about. The class that comes with the Windows Communication Foundation REST Starter Kit, that's the thing you want to look for on CodePlex, is called HTTP Client. This is the class that comes with Preview 2 of that thing. And if you can see here, let me make that font size just a tad bit bigger. I'm not quite sure it's big enough for this room. Let me just go up to about 18. Okay, that's a little bit better. So you'll see that I just create an instance of this HTTP client class. That's that new class that comes here. And I specify the base URI of the REST service. And then from there, you'll notice that that class just has a few simple operations. If I show you the IntelliSense, you'll notice here we have get right there. We have post, put. There's also a delete up here. There's a few others as well. It just makes it really easy to use that uniform interface over any RESTful API. And I just get XML, JSON, or ATOM back, whatever the resource happens to be, and I just write code to process it. So in this case, I'm using the Twitter search API to search Twitter for a bunch of things. You'll notice I'm using search.atom. If I went back to the page, we'd find that there as one of the documented resources that's exposed by Twitter. And I notice I'm just building this little query string here with the Twitter search string that we're passing in. And then because I'm going to get Atom back, I can just use the built-in WCF syndication feed class with syndication items to process that stuff back. I don't need any schema types. I don't need any serializable types. This will work. Anything that returns Atom will work with this. The same model, the same pattern you see here will work with any Atom feed service. You guys have heard of OData, right? OData, that's the thing that they just announced recently at PDC and at Mix recently. It was a big, they talked about it a lot. Microsoft is trying to standardize the use of Atom in conjunction with EF by defining some extensions to Atom that define the data model, what the data model looks like and how that stuff will be embedded within an Atom feed. And so the beauty behind OData is if all that stuff comes to be, then data services and EF is going to become a really powerful way of building all these things. And this kind of code will work with any RESTful service, right? Because it's just Atom you're getting back. You don't need any serializable types necessarily, you know, until you want to start, pulling out the entities and dealing with some of those entities. And then you just use EF for that kind of stuff. You know, you can just use your data model classes. So let's just run this thing and see what it looks like. I mean, very few lines of code. I don't think the SOAP code would have been any simpler than this. Okay? And then I just run it. Let's type in devdays10, the hashtag. That's what everyone's tweeting this week. And we should go out and hit the live Twitter side, and we can see some of the things that people are talking about here. And, pretty simple code. I don't think that would have been any simpler with SOAP. Okay? Let me show you another example. Let's see what it would be like to go and let me create a new project. And make another console app here. We'll call this thing client REST. And we'll go grab that WCF REST starter kit assembly. So if we come in here to browse and we go browse for program files. And come down here, WCF REST. Here's where that starter kit assembly lives. Grab all these guys, put them in here. Okay, and then I'm going to bring in a few system.xml.serialization. I'm going to bring in Microsoft.HTTP. That one right there. So those are the two main things we need. And then let's say that I want to write another client here. Okay, and I'm going to, in fact, let me just do this. Let me jump back over here to Twitter. And let's go, we're going to use the, in fact, let's use this one. Is this the public timeline? It is. Let's just use this one. So I'm going to grab this right here. It'll be publictimeline.xml. And we're going to use, that's the base URI. Then we're going to say get, and we're going to get the public_timeline.xml. Okay, and this gives me back what's called an HTTP response message. Or maybe it's just HTTP response. What's the type? Oh, I missed the S. Oh, my fingers are not working. HTTP response message. Okay. And then here's the cool thing. There's this property called content. And you can read this content in a bunch of different ways. Okay, so if I, let me see if I can do that. Let me see if I can zoom in on that right there. I don't know if you can see that down there, but read as byte array, read as stream. If I bring in, notice I have the XML.serialization namespace in there. You'll see there's also a read as XML serializable. Okay, if I brought in, there's a bunch of extension methods actually that they've added in like this. Let's bring in using system.xml.link. And now if I go back and look at that, we should see read as X element. Right, and there's just a ton of them. You can read it as a syndication feed. If we brought in the syndication feed namespace, that would show up. They've got like 10 different ways that you can read these responses back and deserialize them and deserialize them into classes. Right? So now, you know, instead of thinking about building a service reference from WSDL where you get all these proxy classes and things like that, you really focus on what's the data model going to be for processing the message that I get back from the REST operation. So in this case, let's read it as an XML serializable type, and we'll specify some type here, right? And we're going to just do that, but I need a type. So now the question is, well, how do I go get a type for this Twitter thing, which is out here, which we haven't really, you know, we don't really have any XML, any types for this, and there's no schema definition. Well, let me just copy that XML that I just got back from Twitter into my clipboard, and I'm going to jump back here into my XML file, into my source file. I'm going to come to my edit menu and say, paste XML as types. You guys see that? Let's just do that. Paste XML as types, and voila. We now have some types. These are XML serializable types that you can now just start using, you know, with your RESTful service. These types might not be perfect types. Hey, you get what you pay for, right? They were free. Right? So I might have to go through them a little bit and tweak some things, you know, but, you know, it's going to do a best guess on what the type should look like for that XML instance that we just got back. So here now I can just say, I'm going to read as XML serializable type of statuses. And that's actually going to give me back some statuses. Something like that, right? And then we can say for each, I think it's status is status in statuses dot status. And status is, I believe, an array. Isn't that an array of statuses? Yeah, it's an array of statuses status. So the names aren't very helpful here, but you know, you get the idea. And then for each one of these, we could say console.writeline, and we'll just say SS dot, you know, text. That's the one I want. And let's just see if we can run this piece of code here and see if it works. And there we go. Those are the public timeline statuses that are on the public twitter.com at this moment in time. Right? So what do you think? Is that any harder than SOAP? It's about the same, right? I mean, it's just different. It's just different. But it's I think over time, as you invest in understanding REST, it actually becomes much, much easier. It becomes much easier over time because it's just all, everything's the same. From this point on, everything's the same. And if you get to go to OData and data services, it gets even easier because, you know, the way you build it, the way you consume it, it's just done. You don't have to deal with it, right? You just focus on the app. You focus on writing the business logic. The whole thing, the whole problem is just kind of solved at that point, right? So that's Microsoft's hope. I think we're actually getting to a really good place here if all that comes to fruition here pretty soon. Okay, let me show you one other example of what it's like to build a RESTful service. So that's an example of how you consume one a few different ways. Let's just open up another solution here. And this is, I thought maybe a good example for this group might be to show how you would take a traditional WCF service and port it over. Okay, so if you look at this one here, this started out as a WCF SOAP-based service. I called it a Twitter service. You'll notice the service contract up here has just a bunch of operations on it, like get statuses, get status by user, get status, post status, get status feed, etc. And those are just standard SOAP calls. And so you probably have a bunch of WCF SOAP services like this laying around right now. If you wanted to make those RESTful services with WCF, It's really easy to do. All you have to do is add in a new assembly. It's system.servicemodel.web, okay, for the web service aspect. And if you look here, you'll see that here, right here in my list of references, system.servicemodel.web right there. That's the key one you need. That came in 3.5. All this stuff works as of 3.5. Okay, 4.0, they made things even easier, but you don't have to go all the way to 4.0 to get this. And then you come into your service, and you just start annotating your methods with web get for any get operation, and you specify the URL scheme that we're going to use. So instead of invoking operations based on SOAP action values now, it's going to invoke them based on URLs and HTTP verbs. So if we say we want to get something at a specific address, it then scans our service and says, okay, are there any methods here that are using that particular address? And if it finds a match, it decides, okay, we're going to call that one. And then it figures out how to pass in the data based on that URL template. Notice right here, we've said this URL will be whack users whack user variable. So that's going to be a variable piece that will then be passed in here to the user parameter based on name convention. Okay? And you can do that with query string variables and things like that as well. So we've just got a few different ones here. We've got whack users, whack user, whack status, whack ID. That'll go in there to get a single status. And then we can also create new statuses by posting to users, whack user, a new user with status. Okay, and then we can also get a status feed by putting question mark format equals, you know, RSS or JSON or RSS or Atom on the end, and then it will produce a feed for us. So that's all you have to do. You just have to come in and re-annotate your methods with this URL design that you want to use with your service. Now, if you decide to change method names or XML namespaces or things like that, .NET namespaces, I should say, in your code, it doesn't break your clients because the clients are only based on the HTTP interface, right? They're based on the URL design and based on the verbs, okay? So the other thing you have to do is come into your config file and take out all of the SOAP config. Notice in here, I don't actually, let me just come up here to the top and just collapse everything so you can see. I don't have any system.servicemodel config in here. There is no SOAP-based configuration in this file. I could just delete this whole file. It would still work. Okay? So that you don't need any config with this, right? We don't need any endpoints because there's only one endpoint required for our REST service. And if you look at the SVC file, you'll notice that the SVC file is set up to use a special factory here called the Web Service Host Factory. And that just automatically creates the one endpoint we need with the right configuration, with the right behaviors plugged in. So it's done. You don't have to worry about it, right? And you just get a RESTful service with WCF, just like that. Okay, so if I actually run this thing, is this a web app? Yeah, let me just right-click and browse to this. This thing will come up. We should get to the root address, which gives us back all of the, you know, all of the statuses in our Twitter service. If you remember that URL scheme, we can then say whack users, whack user, like here's Fritz's. There's all of Fritz's statuses. Notice the URL. Right? I can go back and get all of Aaron's statuses. And there are those. Right? And if I want to get a specific status, the URL scheme for that was whack status, whack ID. Like, let's get the third one, and there's just the third status. Right? We could now take a few seconds to post a status in there. You know, but it's kind of nice to be able to, you know, browse your service and interact with it like this without having to write a lot of code. It really helps you figure out what you're, you know, what the code needs to look like just to be able to do this, right, at runtime. So that's it. Now, in addition to WCF, I've chosen WCF as the example. I mean, it's really easy to walk through that porting the code. But there's other ways you can do it, right? The other way you can do it is to use MVC. There's been a lot of talks here this week on MVC. If you use MVC to build a RESTful service, it ends up a lot like a Ruby on Rails application. And that, you know, a lot of people use Ruby on Rails to build RESTful services on other platforms. And you get a lot of that same benefit. You don't have to go the XHTML route like I described in my article, but you can, you know, do MVC. And Scott Hanselman yesterday in his ASP.NET session at the end showed, in his MVC advanced session, showed how to write custom view results, you know, that you can use to return RSS or Atom or JSON or whatever the case may be. And think about how you would build a RESTful service with that framework here. Do the exact same thing. And it would integrate with the rest of your MVC applications if you're using MVC everywhere. Right? So there's a lot of benefit in that. You don't necessarily have to use WCF. And the even better approach is to use a data service. I mean, if your data is in a database specifically, it just makes it so easy. Let me just walk through a quick example of that. Let me create a new ASP.NET web app. And let me come into this thing and say, let's add a new item. And let's just create a new entity data model here. And I'll generate this from a database. We'll select Northwind. Okay, and we'll just come in here and let's just grab all these tables. So we're going to end up with a nice big data model. And, you know, think about CRUD. If your service is primarily doing CRUD, it's just reading and writing data from tables, if that's essentially what it's doing, we can automate this problem, right? We don't have to rewrite the REST service every time for every table, right? We should just be able to have one way of doing it. And that's what this is. That's what data services is all about. It's just one way of doing this. So we can take this data model you're looking at, which is really kind of just this web of things, and I can just basically make a service on top of it. So I can come in here and say, give me a new item. I want a, where is it here? Come down here. I want a data service. Where are you? ADO.NET data service here. And then this gives me the implementation that I need. This is actually built on WCF behind the scenes. What I need to do here is put my data model class over here. So if I jump back over here to my data model, go into the designer down here, this class right here, Northwind Entities, is the name of the class that I want to put right here. So I'm saying I want this automated data service on top of that data model. And then down here, I can come in here and basically set my security configuration. Let's just open it wide up to say everybody can do everything on all the data inside of this thing. You can control it. You can kind of control which pieces you want to let different people use and what access control they'll have to it. But this is good enough. Let's just build it like that. So it's one line of code, essentially. That's the implementation of our data service. And then I can right-click on my new SVC file, my new data service here, browse to it. And what I'm going to get back is basically what's called an Atom service document, which will describe. Did it come up yet? There it is right there. Okay, which describes that whole data model. It describes all the collections that are exposed by this service. That's the root. That's the root of our service. And it shows me relative URLs that I can then browse to go get those collections. So if I want to go get all the customers, I can just say whack customers on the end, and now I've got all the customers. And that's an Atom feed that we're seeing. You don't see the data showing up there because it's kind of hidden within the entity. But let me just show you how to turn off the feed reading view. If I come over here and turn off the feed reading view like this, and let's just open up a new one here. Go to customers again. There's all the customers. And you'll notice that each customer will have a little set of properties down here, and that's where all the data properties go. That's the entity properties right there that you're looking at. Right? So that's kind of what OData is trying to standardize for the world, is how some of this stuff happens to integrate a data model with Atom feeds. And notice I can go to specific customers and get customer details. Like here's the ID to this specific customer, AlfKey. Remember AlfKey? I've got fond memories of AlfKey. I've used AlfKey a lot. Okay, you look here, then we get all of AlfKey's details down here, right? And you can just kind of browse around. If I wanted to go find all of AlfKey's orders, I can now browse to those. So that took me no code, essentially, and I now have a fully RESTful service. We can do get, post, put, and delete against this data model over REST, using standard XML feeds, and it's easy to program. Now, instead of using syndication feeds in my programming model like I would in WCF, I can now just use entity framework classes to process all this data. On the client side now, I can do link expressions to go query my REST service, get a bunch of customers back, and I can do link queries against them. And behind the scenes, it's just doing RESTful, you know, requests and responses on the wire. But you're actually doing link code in .NET. And it's pretty darn natural. And anybody else who's not using .NET can still go and, you know, do whatever they want. It's just XML, right? It's just Atom. So hopefully that illustrates. I just wanted to take a few seconds to illustrate, you know, what it's like, you know, to build RESTful services, you know, on the Microsoft platform at least, and that it's really no harder than anything else that we've done in the past. It's just a little bit different. And hopefully, you know, as we've gone talked through this thing, you know, when you might use one versus the other makes a little more sense. And obviously, this is definitely the way things are working on the cloud. As you approach Windows Azure, you know, all the APIs we use there are fully REST-based, and it's the same thing. You know, once you know how to write code against the Twitter REST API, you essentially know how to write code against the Windows Azure REST APIs. Okay? So we're done, and I'm, you know, in untypical fashion for me, we're actually done a few minutes early. So we can take time now for Q&A. Any questions on anything that we talked about? Yes, sir. Does REST support multiple? Oh, like multiple inserts. Does it support batch operations? You can design that into your REST service. Okay, so you could design a POST request that took an entity, a resource, that represented a bunch of changes. That's something that you would have to build into your system. Actually, you know, ADO.NET Data Services does provide support for that type of stuff to do multiple updates. So it just depends on the REST service and what the implementation provides. As you start, you know, going beyond just a single entity, you can do anything you want. And you can even do transactions. Like, think about how you would do. The one question that comes up a lot is, how would I do something that's not really a resource? Like, I want to transfer money between bank accounts. That's really a transaction. There's not one resource that I talk to do that. Well, in a RESTful situation, you would actually make it a resource. You would say, well, really, a transaction or a transfer between accounts is a resource. When you go to the bank and you say, I want to transfer money between accounts, you actually get a receipt back that identifies that thing you just did. That's a resource, right? And so you would just design in your service, say, transfers are a resource. And I'd have a transfers URI that I would post requests to initiate a transfer. And that'd be transactional. That whole thing would have to happen within the scope of a transaction. It either works or it doesn't. It's atomic. And then if it works, I get a receipt back that says, hey, I just did this transaction, and here's the receipt. Here's the ID for it. And now I can reference it. If I want to go get that receipt again in the future, I can always go back to that URI to get that receipt and view it, view all the details. And so, you know, you kind of have to take a step back and think about, you know, how you would model some of those operations in a RESTful way. Any other questions? Yes. How do you secure access to your data? Well, typically you would use the exact same techniques that you use in your web app. So if you've, you know, whatever you're doing in your web app, those same principles can typically be just placed right into your RESTful service. Typically you'll be using SSL, some type of authentication mechanism, and, you know, different types of authorization mechanisms. As you know, there's lots of different ways to do that on the web today. So whatever works on the web will work with this. And that's typically what you'll use. The main thing you lose typically when you go down this path is the message-based, the message-centric security, where you want to encrypt or sign pieces of the message. That's the one thing you tend to give up when you go down this path. But you can still do things like federation and some of those things. Keith Brown will be giving, I don't know, is Keith still here? Yeah, Keith, are you doing any other sessions this week on that? So he's got a Windows Identity Framework or Windows Identity Foundation session. Are you going to be talking about REST stuff in there?
I'll talk a little bit about it.
Okay. He will talk about that now. So thank you, Keith. Yeah, question here.
When you use link on the client side, are those predicates somehow transferred in the GET?
Yeah, so the question is, if I use link on the client side, is it somehow transferring, you know, the predicates that I use in my code across the wire? And yes, it is. It's basically taking the code you write in that expression and is building a URI that knows how to basically do that on the other side. And so what the thing they've done with data services is they've standardized what that URI scheme is, what operations you can use in those expressions, and what those should look like once they get transferred into the URI. So that's just all done. And it's a blessing and a curse at the same time, because you can't really change it. So you're either kind of all the way in or not, because it's hard to kind of go back and modify what the URL design is later. A lot of people that do REST like to have a real clean and simple URL scheme. And with data services, if you're unhappy with what they've given you, then it gets kind of tricky to go back and... You can do it. You can make some changes, but it's not trivial. Yes, over here.
I have an impression that comparing SOAP and REST is a bit fake. SOAP is a protocol and REST is more a concept, I would say.
Okay. So the observation is, comparing REST and SOAP may not be appropriate, because REST is more of an architectural style, whereas SOAP is a protocol or a message framework, a framing mechanism. And, you know, that's true to some degree. But there is a style of design, you know, that is inherent in most SOAP platforms, in most SOAP frameworks. And you can break free from that. But most people, when they do so, to answer your question, you're right, right? I mean, SOAP and REST can both be used in a very message-centric way, you know, with a variety of different transports and protocol scheme, or, you know, message formats. You don't have to, you know, just use one. REST doesn't have to be HTTP even, right? But in practice, when you do these things, most SOAP services in practice are heavily RPC-based. Every single one that I come in contact with is. And, I mean, it takes someone to really break free from that, and you don't typically use a framework when you do that, because most frameworks are inherently RPC-based. And so the fundamental difference between REST and SOAP, in my opinion, is SOAP is RPC-based and REST is not, in practice. That's just the way it works. And so when you care about things like versioning messages and what your service versioning scheme will be over time, REST is an inherently a little more decoupled model, and it tends to work better. And they're not exactly the same thing, but it's the choice that people are often thinking about. It's usually, do I do REST or do I do SOAP? Any other questions? I think we're out of time, so thanks for coming. If you have a question, just come on up. Thanks.